behind him. Mosquitoes started to light on my face and hands, and one got his stinger on my back through my blouse. Les put his groceries down, unlocked the door, then felt his way along a wall and struck a match to one of those camping lanterns that hiss and give off the light of a bare bulb. He took the lamp and hung it by its handle from a ceiling hook in the middle of the room, the walls and floors made of pine planks that were weathered or stained a dark brown. I smelled something a little rotten. Lester took my grocery bag and put it on a 3-foot-thick chopping block beneath the hanging lamp. On his way to get the groceries from the porch, he stopped and kissed me, hugged me to him. "You hungry?" "I could eat," I said into his chest. I could smell his aftershave, and I hugged him tight before he went outside. Under a wooden staircase, against the wall, was a black iron wood stove. Les got a fire going in it in no time, and even though it made the room a little too warm, it was nice seeing the flames and smelling the smoke. Next to an army cot in the corner was a plastic ice chest, and Les opened it and found an old chicken carcass floating in the water. "Shit." "Nope, I think it's chicken, Lester." He let out a laugh, carried the cooler down to the river, taking the gas lantern with him. In the firelight, I unloaded the groceries onto the chopping block, then looked around for something to cook with. On a crate, underneath the stairwell, was a short stack of pots and pans, and I dusted off a black iron skillet, put it on the stove above the flames, then unwrapped the steaks and laid them in. When Les came back, he opened a bottle of red wine he'd bought, and I poured some over the cooking meat. He handed me a paper cup of it and stood with me in front of the stove, drinking. I drank too, swallowing my vow not to, feeding the enemy voice in my head. I thought he might put his arm around me or something, but he didn't. He just stood there beside me, looking down at the wood fire and the stove, the steaks cooking. So I put my arm around him. After a very quiet supper, we ate off paper plates on our laps in front of the flames. We went upstairs to the loft, undressed in the light from the gas lantern, and got into bed, a queen-size mattress on the floor. The sheets felt cool and a little gritty against my skin, and I wondered when they were last washed, who slept here before. I wanted to wash my face and brush my teeth, but there wasn't a bathroom, even a sink. I curled up to Les and rested my hand and cheek on his bare chest. I could hear the gas hiss from the lantern. It made a kind of shadowed light, and I saw how low the ceiling was, the bare rafters running at a steep angle to short walls. Just 2 half-windows on each side, mosquitoes and moths flying at the screens, Lester's heart beating against my hand. Without lifting my head, I asked him if he was all right. "Yes, I'm all right." His voice was tired and sounded weak. "All right but sad, huh?" He took a long breath and let it out his nose. I could feel it move my hair. "I just keep seeing my father drive off in his packed station wagon. I swore I'd never do that to my own, Kathy." Something fluttered inside me. "Do you want to go home?" "That's not home." I thought I knew what he meant, but I didn't want to press him. I moved my hand down just to let my fingers nestle in the coarse hair there, but he grew hard right away, and our conversation seemed to continue, though neither of us spoke again. The next day, Sunday, was just that, full of sun. I had to pee first thing, so Lester handed me a roll of toilet paper, kissed me, and told me to find a spot in the woods. After, he told me to bring my toothbrush, and he showed me a trail behind the camp that led through the pine trees to a clearing at the river. In the soft ground was an upside-down aluminum rowboat resting on a tree stump. The river was calm and wide here and seemed to end in the trees. It looked more like a pond, surrounded on 3 sides with woods, which was strange because I could still hear its water running back down through the stone bed. "Won't it drain itself?" Lester put his arm around my shoulders. "It's fed by an underground river. How often do you get to see that in life? The source of something." 3 dragonflies ticked along the surface to tall grass at the edge of the water. Les squatted and began to brush his teeth. I did too, spitting on the ground behind me, rinsing my mouth with cool water from my cupped hand. Lester filled a tin pot, and back at the cabin we drank scalding coffee on the small front porch and ate bread we'd toasted on the stove. Lester's hair stuck out a little in places, and he hadn't shaved. He was leaning back in his chair, his sneakered feet up on the railing, drinking his coffee, and he looked good, like the pain he'd felt last night was only from his dreams. I lit a cigarette. We gonna clean this place up or what? How's your foot? I can put all my weight on it. We should get damages for that, too, the bastards. Who you gonna call about that? A bunch of people. Tomorrow's lawyer day. He looked at me and smiled, then stood and tossed the last of his coffee over the railing. Let's do it. We spent the morning and early afternoon cleaning the whole cabin, and it was filthy. Under the dust on the floor around the chopping block were fish scales stuck to the planks. I got down on my hands and knees and scraped them off with a spoon. In the corners were dust webs 4 and 5 feet long, and all around the card table by the window were cigarette and cigar butts. While I was sweeping, Les heated 2 small pots of river water on the wood stove, then he mopped the floor after me. He didn't have any detergent to use, so I poured in some glass cleaner I'd found under the pots and pans crate. There was a ripped T-shirt there, too, and I went to work cleaning the windows and screens. At first I'd wanted my Walkman, some fast beat in my head to keep me going, but after a while I didn't miss the music. It was nice just hearing the squeak of the rag on cleaner against glass, the gurgling of the Parissima River through the trees, Lester working with me. In the corner of the porch, next to a rusted-out barbecue grill, was a dirty blanket, and under it was a long axe, a yellow chainsaw, and a plastic gallon jug half full of what looked like oil and gas. Les found a pair of pliers and a screwdriver, and he tightened the chain blade, then got the thing started. It spewed out blue smoke and was as loud as a dirt bike, and he carried it off into the trees, and I heard him cutting for a long time. I was glad when he stopped. I walked out there, still limping a bit, and helped him carry logs back to the camp. He had cut up some kind of smooth-barked tree, maple, he thought, a hard wood that would burn well in the stove. We made 3 trips each. He'd load my arms up, then grab 2 armfuls and follow me to the house. On the way back for more logs, we held hands and Lester pointed out different kinds of wildflowers in the trees, or else we just walked through the heat of the woods together, sweating and breathing a little hard from the work, the sun on us in places, nothing but the sound of the river and a few birds. Once we got all the logs in a pile in front of the porch, Lester took off his shirt and started splitting them with the axe. I went down to the Parissima with a plastic cup and filled and drank 3 times, then brought Lester some. The sweat was dripping off his nose and mustache, and he smiled and thanked me, drank the water, then leaned over and gave me a short, wet kiss. I smoked a cigarette on the porch step and watched him split wood a while. His shoulders and back were gleaming with sweat, and veins were starting to come out in his long arms. Sometimes he would let out a little grunt as he swung the axe down onto the end of a log, then he'd kick the split wood aside, bend over to prop up another full log, and swing again. A fly landed on his face and walked across his cheek to his ear, but Lester didn't even seem to notice it. I thought at first it was because he was concentrating so hard on what he was doing, but then I began to wonder if it wasn't something else. If Lester was maybe thinking about his family, his wife and kids. And I hoped he wasn't. I left the porch and went inside to make tuna fish sandwiches. After a few more logs, Lester stopped and walked back through the trees towards his car. Then I saw him walking back to the camp, carrying his suitcase, his dry-cleaned uniform and clothes on hangers draped over his shoulder. He was still bare-chested, the sunlight on him as he stepped into the clearing whistling some tune through his teeth. I was relieved to hear it. I really liked being with Lester Burden. I thought how this morning I'd felt more like myself than I had in a long time, maybe since the first days with Nick. And I wanted it to be good for Les, too. And when I heard him whistling, I hurried to the door to take his clothes on hangers from him, and he kissed me deep. pulling me to his slick chest. Up in the hot loft, we took off our clothes and lay down together on the mattress. The room smelled almost like an attic, like dry wood and old furniture stuffing. But I could smell the woods outside the open screen windows, too, the pine and eucalyptus, the hardwood tree Lester had cut up. And I could smell my own wetness as I lay on my back and Les licked me and I reached down and held his head in both my hands, my eyes on the rafters above me. I thought of Nicky the morning he left, the way he sat on the edge of the bed and just looked at me. Just that. Looked at me. Then I thought of my house, mine and Frank's, of that Arab family living there, having parties there. What Les was doing felt good, warm and slightly electric, but I was thinking too much to let go into the orgasm I knew he was trying to give me. I pulled away and took him in my mouth until he came against the back of my throat and I swallowed. I moved up and kissed him while he tried to push himself back inside me, but he'd gone soft, and so we lay there a while, holding each other, our skin sticking. I wanted a cigarette, but I didn't want to move. My wife never did that to me. Did you like it? Did you? Yeah? Good. What if I didn't like it, though? You didn't? No, I did, but what if I didn't? He kissed my upper cheek. Then I wouldn't like it either. Bullshit. Well, it's true, Kathy. He got up on one elbow and looked me long in the face, his mustache and eyes calling dark attention to themselves. It's true. I kissed him, opening my mouth, and he slid back on top of me. Man, I'm in trouble, Les. I believe everything you say. He began to move, and my mouth tasted sour, and I wanted one of those tall Budweisers in the ice chest downstairs. I raised my legs up and held his back, and I wanted him to let go inside me, deep inside, where everything I say has another side to it, like telling him to wear a condom when I know I don't want him to do anything like that at all. Not at all.
Quite early Sunday morning, I carry to my son's room a tray of sugar and hot tea, and I tell to him everything we face as a family. A smile sits up in his bed with no shirt upon him, his eyes still heavy with sleep, his black hair uncombed. He drinks his tea and listens quite intently as I explain the young woman with whom he spoke on the grass Saturday afternoon. He looks away from my eyes. She said this is her house, Baba John, and it was taken away from her for no reason. No, as I have just said, there was a reason. She did not pay her taxes, Ismail. This is what happens when we are not responsible. Farmikuni, do you understand? Yes, Baba. I do not like lying to my son, but I am certain if he knows the woman's home was taken from her due only to bureaucratic mistake, he will not be able to keep all of this from Nadere. We own the home now, Ismail. We purchased it legally, and that woman has no right to harass us. This is why I do not want you telling to your mother any of these things. You know how easily she can become sick with her worries. Mohamnis, Baba John, no problem. I nod my head and drink from my tea, weighing whether or not I should tell to him more, that I had planned for us to stay here until cooler weather began, but now I feel compelled to sell and leave while it is still clear no one has legal recourse against us. And I enjoy sitting here with a smile, discussing serious matters. It has been the nature of my life's work to keep secrets and to bear heavy responsibility for others. But oftentimes, I feel very tired and quite alone. And of course, it is an important moment for a smile to have his father confide in him for the first time. My son sits straight in his bed, his brown shoulders pulled back while he holds his teacup and saucer and nods his head along with me. You know I must raise money for your university education. I can get another paper route. Manmidunam, I know. And you must begin saving your money. Yes, Baba. Tomorrow, people are coming to view this house for buying. If we are fortunate, we can make a large amount of money. Wish me bright eyes, son. Will we have to move? Yes, but we will have enough pool to live well, perhaps to buy more property or start a business. My son stares across the room at the blank screen of his computer, but I know he is not seeing this. I begin to regret telling him my affairs. Baba John? Yes. We were rich in Iran, weren't we? Weren't we, Puldar? He regards me as if he has not seen me in a long while, his mouth open slightly. I stand to leave. Yes and no, son. Yes and no. It is my belief people feel more free to spend their money in good weather, so I am disappointed today, Monday, with its gray sky and its fog bank along the beach. From the widow's walk I can see no ocean, only a whiteness down beneath the rooftops of Corona. Also, my first appointment telephoned to cancel, stating they had seen a property over the weekend they could not turn down. I tried to talk the gentleman into at least seeing my bungalow, but he was not to be moved. At noon, Saraya arrives to take Nadi to lunch. My daughter is dressed tastefully in a skirt and blouse and jewelry, her black hair held back with a silver ornament. I am on the roof as she steps out of the car and waves and blows to me a kiss. This morning she told Nadi on the telephone she is enjoying decorating their new condominium in Mountain View, over 1 hour's drive south of us. And she is a good daughter to have driven so far to lunch with her mother at a fine restaurant in San Francisco. I did not tell Nadi of my appointments today, and I am grateful she will be gone from the house. After they leave, I descend the stairs to ask Ismail to do the same, to leave, but he has already disappeared, his skateboard gone as well. I suspect he is making friends with the local young people along the beach here. Now the bungalow is empty and silent, and for a brief moment, I feel quite lost standing in its rooms without my family. I inspect it once more for order and cleanliness, but I need not worry. Nadi takes care of every room, as if we are expecting special guests each day.
Les woke me before dawn Monday morning with a cup of that too-hot cowboy coffee from the wood stove. The Coleman lantern was turned low, not even hissing, and in the shadows I could see he was in his uniform, with his badge and gun, his hair combed and still wet from the river. He squatted on one knee at the corner of the mattress and said he'd heated me up a basin of water to clean up in. I could stay here, or he could drop me off at the Eureka to get my things. Get my things? He glanced down at his hands. If you want to. I do, Les. I nudged his back with my foot. You've got a weird way of asking, though. I'm shy, Kathy. He smiled, then stopped. Will you know how to get back here on your own? Yep. I dressed in front of him, then peed in the dark woods and brushed my teeth on the porch, using a cup of warm water to rinse my mouth. On the drive back to San Bruno, Les told me about the two lawyers he knew in town who would get me back into my house in no time. The sky was beginning to lighten, though it was gray and the beaches seemed to be one long fog bank. I sat there in the passenger seat with my feet up on the dash, feeling almost confident that everything would get worked out. At the motor lodge, Les paid the bill and carried my suitcase to my car. We kissed goodbye and promised to meet back at the fish camp by 7 o'clock tonight. He said to be careful driving that luxury car of mine up the Pine Trail, then he was gone. I sat in my car a few minutes and smoked a cigarette, flicking my ashes out the window. I was starting to feel jittery, though I'd only had half a cup of Lester's coffee, and my fingers were shaking a little as I smoked my second cigarette, though I'd meant to light just one. In group, we'd coax all our snakes and gargoyles into the room and smoke our lungs sore and our eyes bloodshot while we got clear on everything else. And I knew to any of my counselors back east my life wouldn't look very manageable. I was drinking again, and smoking. I was sleeping with a man who'd just left his family, all while I was supposed to be getting back the house I'd somehow lost. I knew they would call the drinking a slip, the smoking a crutch, the lovemaking sex as medication, and the house fiasco a disaster my lack of recovery had invited upon itself and on me. In RR, it would be time to turn to self-control and self-worth reminders, use my powers of reason to tell myself how lovable I was, how I didn't need to do anything dangerous because I'd be endangering a good person, me. I knew what all the rationally recovered assholes would say, but it wasn't me loving me I was interested in. It was Lester loving me. He and I living on Bisgrove Street, both working during the day only to spend time together at night, snuggling in front of the TV or else going to bed early to make love. And that's what it was beginning to feel like, love. Later, as I cleaned my Monday residential, running the vacuum over carpets, mopping the floor, you'd think my mind would be on my house for most of the day, but it wasn't. It was Lester, his tall, skinny gentleness, his smell, like sweet, damp ground, the way he paid such attention to me. And I was thinking of kids again. I wanted to see pictures of his son and daughter. I wanted to know their ages and their favorite snacks. I knew lots of men who'd started second families, had babies again when their first kids were almost on their own. But I was getting way ahead of us, wasn't I? Around noon, I picked up my mail at the post office, then went to a shopping center sandwich shop to sift through it all while I ate. It was only 10 days' worth, but it took up all of my table, and I put it in two piles, one for the trash can on the way out, one to keep. The trash pile was mostly junk mail. The other was bills, car insurance, gas, my final phone and electric. The electric bill was the most recent, and I opened it and read the cutoff date for the last billing period. Just 2 days ago. I tore into my turkey sandwich and drank down some Diet Coke, and I shook my head at how fucked up this was. It was the same with the gas bill. My first thought was to call Connie Walsh again, but I knew she'd only tell me to call the utility companies and set them straight. I didn't want to hear that. I pushed my sandwich away and lit a cigarette, looked out the window at the shopping center parking lot, at all the cars under the hazy sky. I was reaching for the ashtray when I saw the postcard in my bill pile, a glossy picture of the Hilltop Steakhouse back in Saugus on Route 1. In front of the restaurant was a huge fiberglass cactus maybe 50 feet high, and all around it, on a small fenced-in lawn, were a dozen life-size steers. I knew the card was from my mother, and I took another drag and drank from my Coke before I started to read it. Dear Kay, your telephone is out of order. Have you two gotten unlisted? Your aunts won 2 round-trip tickets to San Francisco. I may go with them Labor Day. Send me your new number. Mother. I left the sandwich shop and stepped into a drugstore for a notebook. Back in my car, I wrote, Hi, Ma. I'm sorry I haven't called you. A bad earth tremor rolled through here last week and a tree hit the phone lines down the street. As soon as they're fixed, I'll let you know. Also, that's good news about your coming out here, but Nick and I won't be in town that weekend. He's taking me on a business trip. Sorry to miss you. Kay. I wondered if I should put in anything extra about the tremor, what it feels like to be in one, maybe, but then thought, no, she wouldn't expect that from me. Then I wrote letters to the gas and electric companies explaining my situation, telling them to bill a Mr. Barmini instead of me. I drove back to the post office to mail them, but when I dropped my mother's letter into the box, I felt as if I'd just heaved my last sandbag against rising water and there wasn't much time left. It was barely 1 o'clock and I had 6 hours to kill before I met Les back at the camp. I thought about going there early to make us a nice dinner, surprise him, but then I pictured myself trying to build a fire in the stove, not having an oven to use. And my specialty was casserole dishes, lasagna, veal and eggplant parmesan. I decided to go to a movie instead, 1 or 2 weekday matinees at the Mall Cineplex in Millbrae, off the Camino Real. Last night, as we were drifting to sleep, my cheek on his shoulder, I asked him his kids' names again. Bethany and Nate, he said, his voice full of gratitude. Then I asked him where his house was, and when he said it was in Millbrae, in a housing development you had to drive by to get to the mall, I told him I'd probably driven past his house 12 times. Maybe I'd even seen his wife. Carol, he said. Yeah, Carol. But now, instead of passing through San Bruno for the highway to Millbrae, I drove into foggy downtown Corona, then right up the long hill of Bisgrove Street. I wanted to pull over beside the woods across from my house and just look at it a few minutes, maybe remind myself of what was mine before I went off to numb my afternoon away in a dark theater. And I guess I didn't really expect to see anyone there. But a station wagon was parked by the woods, so I could only park near the house, and I didn't want to do that because there were people standing in my yard looking at my home. A man and woman, and a young boy, maybe 8. He had his hands in his shorts pockets, and he was kicking one foot into the grass. His father's hand was on his shoulder, and they were all looking at what Colonel Barmini was pointing out to them, the new deck on my roof. The bald Arab wore a tie and a short-sleeved dress shirt that looked very white in the grayness. He glanced at me in my car, but then turned away as if he hadn't seen anything. He was talking fast, officially, though I couldn't hear his exact words through my open window. He looked back at me one more time before he led the young family up the steps to the roof for a view that must be foggy. I couldn't believe what I was seeing, and a sick laugh rose up from my stomach. The fucking bastard was trying to sell my house! Then I just honked my horn, leaning on it with both hands. I looked straight ahead, and I could feel the steering wheel vibrate. 2 houses up, a woman stuck her head out her front door and stared. But I kept my weight on the wheel, letting that sound tear through the air until my wrists started to ache and I let go and yelled through the window, "He can't sell you that house! He doesn't own it! He's trying to fucking steal it! He's trying to sell you a stolen house!" The man was half smiling, like he didn't know if this was a joke or not. He looked from me to Barmini, then back at me again. His wife stepped closer to her son, and the colonel's face was still as stone. I pushed on the gas and sped up the hill and turned around at the dead end. I drove back and honked the horn again. The colonel was standing near the railing talking to the man and woman, and now he nodded his head and pointed in my direction as if my noise proved some point he was trying to make. But I didn't care what he said. I kept going, my hand pressed to the horn all the way down the hill.
Nadire returned from her afternoon with Soraya in high spirits. After their luncheon, they had shopped, and Nadi was quite excited to show me my new shirt and tie, the pants and sweatshirt she purchased for Esmail. She also pulled from her bags more tape cassettes of Persian music, and she put one of them into the machine while she set about preparing our dinner. The music was most recent, and I did not like it. There were still the old instruments being used, the tar, kamanche, and dombak, but electric guitar as well, and the singer sounded to me like a whining child. I was surprised Nadi had chosen it. I watched her fill the rice pot with water from the sink, moving her head slightly and feeling with the music, and I pressed the machine's off button. Nadire turned her head to me immediately. "Nakon Masood, what is wrong for you?" "You must not spend so much money, Nadire." "It is not so much money," she said in Farsi, smiling. "There are school sales now. Even your clothes, Behrani." She walked to me, drying her hands upon her apron. She kissed my cheek, then pressed the music on once again and resumed her cooking. And I knew I could not tell her my worries. I knew I would prefer to have her this way, cheerful and innocent as a child. But there were flames in my stomach, and now, after dinner, I sit upon my widow's walk at the new table under the umbrella looking down over the rooftops and streets of Corona to the gray fog that enshrouds the beach and the sea. It is 2 or more hours to nightfall. I drink hot tea, strong from brewing the samovar since morning, and I can hear my wife in the house below washing dishes in the kitchen sink. The sky and ocean are so gray and white as to be inseparable. I sit and think. I must weigh my options regarding this Cathy Nicolo, but my hand trembles, my mind roaming elsewhere, to Jasmine, my cousin, who was 19 years old and very beautiful. Her voice was low for a woman, but her body was long and thin, her hair quite thick and black, and when she thought something was humorous, she would laugh without reservation, letting her teeth and bright eyes be seen by anyone. But she had an affair with an American oil executive, who they say was rich and quite handsome. She committed this in a townhouse, which one of her own neighbors cleaned 3 times per week. Soon, All the village women knew she had given her girl's flower away without marriage, without the blessing of God in the holy mosque, and to a married foreigner from the West. And it took a full month for the news to reach her father, my uncle, and her two brothers. My uncle was a trader in carpets, though not highly successful, while his only brother, my father, was a respected lawyer who would one day become a judge. When my uncle finally heard the gossip of the old Khanums, he did not believe it. But Jasmine was not capable of telling lies well, and so he knew it was the truth, and he beat her. For 2 weeks, he kept her locked in the home. He began to drink vodka nightly, at first with the neighborhood men, but he could not bear their silence, so he drank alone, usually at his shop in the back room where the carpets hung from the walls or were stacked in long rolls in all four corners. My uncle rolled his own cigarettes, and I imagined him smoking his black Turkish tobacco and drinking in the stillness and quiet of his office, the walls threatening to collapse upon him. He would return home very late, often in the early morning, pull Jasmine from her bed and beat her with his fist, crying, "Jende, whore!" My aunt would sometimes attempt to stop him, but he would beat her as well, calling her "Modar Jende," mother whore. On the first morning of the third week, his eldest son, Mahmoud, returned home from the bazaar after having overheard 5 market women speak of the Behrani family, of the shame their Kasif daughter had brought upon their heads. It was a cold winter morning, and my uncle had not yet left for his shop. He sat by the wood stove with his tea and bread, though he took neither. He had once again not slept through the night and was still mast, drunk. My aunt had left the home early with Mahmoud, and she was at the bazaar, while my cousin Kamfar, the youngest child, sat at the wooden table with his morning schoolwork, and it was Mahmoud who rushed into Jasmine's room and pulled her out. She was dressed in long white night clothes, her hair loose and wild upon her shoulders, her small face bruised and swelled from the beatings. He brought her before their father and yelled he must do something. "The family is disgraced, Baba. We are all disgraced because of this stinking Jinde." Jasmine struggled with her brother, cursing him, but he would not release her, and my uncle looked away from his son and daughter and stared into the fire as if he could not hear or see or smell anything around him. At last he stood. He left the room and returned with his German-made Luger pistol. Jasmine was still attempting to free herself from Mahmoud's hands, but when she saw her father and his gun, she began to scream until it seemed she could not breathe. She began to cry Kamfar's name, but when he stood, his father pointed the gun and ordered him to stay seated. He took Jasmine by the hair, and with his eldest son's help, dragged her outdoors. The ground was frozen, but there was no snow. The house was only a short walk to the village square, and one could see the long bread and trinket tables of the bazaar, a cage of chickens, the butcher's meat hanging from a timber. Already passers-by stopped to view the spectacle of the carpet dealer pointing a pistol at his dirty Kasif daughter, whose hands were held behind her by her bearded older brother, who stood to the side, his eyes on the eyes of their father. The girl was in white night clothes, her feet bare, already beginning to turn blue, her black hair hanging before her face as she cried so hard she was unable to speak. The men and women of the bazaar began to look as well, and perhaps they saw the youngest son run from the house just as his father pulled the trigger. The sound like the cracking of ice, a wisp of smoke entering the air, and the young, beautiful Jasmine, the Jende, the whore, falling to the ground, curling herself up as if she were cold, moaning, then becoming quiet and with great concentration, sitting up and pressing her hands to the hole in her chest. But in seconds, the front of her gown was completely red and wet, and quite soon she lay still, her eyes open, steam rising from her wound into the early morning air of Tabriz. I hated my uncle, believing he had acted rashly and with too much passion. We are an educated family. We do not need to live as the peasant class, resolving our troubles with spilled blood. My aunt took Kamfar and moved to her family in the south, to Bandar Abbas on the Strait of Hormuz. But none of her brothers or uncles could take revenge on Jasmine's killer. A man has the right, even the obligation, to protect his family name. Many years later, when I was married and a smile was not yet born, Kamfar told to me the details of the story while we were masked with Russian vodka, and we both wept for Jasmine. Soraya was a girl of 8 or 9 years, and in my drunkenness I could not allow myself to even imagine raising merely an unloaded pistol to her. And over the years I have dreamed of Jasmine in white falling to the ground, Mahmoud standing over her as she attempted in vain to keep life from leaving her, pressing her hands to the torn opening between her breasts. The hurting of women I have not approved of, though yes, I have struck my wife on occasion, but I regretted each incident deeply. Once at our home in Tehran, I slapped Nadi's face for raising her voice to me in the presence of a junior officer. Her eyes filled with sadness and humiliation, and she ran crying from the room. Later that evening, when she would still to me not speak, I rolled up my shirt sleeve, lighted a Turkish cigar, and pressed the glowing ash into my flesh. I wanted to cry out, but did not. I relighted the cigar and burned myself again. I did this 5 times, and I asked God for forgiveness with each burning of the flesh. The white scar on my forearm remains, and it is a reminder to me for controlling my passion. But today, when this woman, Kathy Nicolo, assaulted my buyers and me from her automobile, when I felt the sail of the bungalow begin to slip past me like the wind, I wanted to shoot her in the head. For with each of her false accusations, she was attempting to take from me not simply my future, but my family's food and water, our shelter, our clothes. I explained to the gentleman and lady that this was a crazy woman. She knows nothing of what she speaks. I am pleased to show you all the paperwork for the sale of this home. I am its proper owner. The man and woman regarded one another, and then we spoke of other matters, such as the proximity of the home to the beaches in San Francisco, the quiet nature of this street. The husband said they would telephone me with the decision, but I knew as I escorted them and the child to their family automobile, I had lost them. Perhaps I should reconsider my decision to complete these dealings without a real estate agent. I have heard of many people who have put down payments upon homes after only viewing color photographs of the property in the realtor's office. This would allow me to not worry about this Kasif woman spoiling things. But no, I cannot allow a salesman to take a heavy percentage of what is rightfully mine. I will wait for calls on the property, and if this woman troubles me again, she will simply wish she had not. That is all. There is no more to consider.
My visit to Bisgrove Street left me feeling worse, like I'd just fanned a fire I was trying to put out. I skipped the matinee and went food shopping instead, then drove south to the fish camp to surprise Les with some kind of meal when he showed up at 7, hopefully with some good lawyer news. It was only 2:30 when I drove the Bonneville up the Pine Trail, but I couldn't go very far because Lester's Toyota station wagon was already parked there. In front of it was a red pickup truck, and on the rear window was a faded "Let Go and Let God" bumper sticker beneath a small trout fishing decal. I got out with my 2 bags of groceries and squeezed past the station wagon and truck, the pine branches messing up my hair. As I carried the groceries into the clearing, I saw Lester and a man on the front porch, though they hadn't seen me yet. Lester was sitting in a cane chair against the wall, still in his uniform, looking down at the floor, a beer can in one hand. The man was leaning against the railing with his back to me and the woods. He was wearing jeans and a dark blue short-sleeved shirt, his arms thick. I stepped on a twig, and Les raised his head, but for a half second his face didn't change from what it was before. He looked at me like I was someone he didn't know who had just walked in on something private. But then his face softened up and he stood and met me at the steps, taking a bag and kissing me on the cheek. "You're early," I said. "You too." Les motioned to his big friend and introduced us. His name was Doug, and this was his camp. Doug smiled, nodded at me, and drank from a can of ginger ale, his wedding band catching my eye. His square, fleshy face might have been good-looking if his head weren't practically shaved. I noticed how big his chest and biceps were. He reminded me of a lot of men back east, and I didn't like it. I followed Les inside with the groceries. He seemed skinnier than usual. I went over and hugged him. "You look pretty low. What's up?" He held me for a long, quiet minute, then let go. "Carol's real upset." I heard Doug step off the porch and walk away from the cabin, and I didn't know what Lester was trying to say. I took the food from the bags, a sudden current in my chest. Les looked out the screen door at the trees on the other side, though he didn't seem to see them. She was waiting in the car with the kids when I got to work this morning, and she began shouting and crying, hitting me. The kids were still in their pajamas, and they were crying too. It was bad. I had that floating feeling again, my heart beating somewhere in the air in front of me. I started to fold an empty paper bag. Les stayed quiet and was putting a crease in a bag that was already creased. "Are you going back to her, Lester?" "That's not an option, Kathy." "Why?" I wanted to know. "Because she would never take him back now anyway? Or because he was really committed to this new road he was on? This road with me?" But there was an edge in his voice, like he could yell or cry or both if I pushed him. And I pictured his son and daughter in their pajamas crying in the car. I wanted to hold him, but I lit a cigarette instead, blew the smoke out the side of my mouth. "I'm sorry your kids had to be there. That must have been hard." "It was." Les pushed open the screen door with his toe, his back to me. "I should go help Doug with his boat. He's trading it in for something bigger." I inhaled deeply on my cigarette, then rested it on the very edge of the chopping block, balancing it there, a tremor in my fingers as I let all the heat out of my lungs. "Les?" "Yeah?" "This all would have happened anyway, wouldn't it? If you hadn't met me?" He turned to me like he was surprised I'd said that, his lips parted under his mustache. He let the screen door close behind him and came over and hugged me, told me of course it would. It was all going to happen sooner or later. He stepped back and looked at me with a hand on both my shoulders. "It's not you, Kathy. It's not you at all." I felt better, but also left out, like a little sister, and I stepped away from him to finish my cigarette. "I know this is shitty timing, but did you get a chance to call your lawyers about the house?" He said no, he hadn't, but he was planning to do that before tonight. He came over and kissed me, tasting like sour beer, the way it gets old in the mouth. Then he said he'd drive up to Half Moon Bay right now and make the calls, be back in no time. I told him I was blocking them both in with my car, and I handed him my keys as he stepped out into the gray light, ducking his head as he left the porch. I moved to the door and watched him walk to the river trail, his shoulders hunched slightly, his head low, like there was still something he had to duck. I smoked a cigarette in the doorway while they carried the aluminum skiff through the clearing past our woodpile, then up the trail until I couldn't see them anymore. I could hear Doug's calm voice, and I wondered if they were talking about me. I wondered what Les had told him about us, and I pictured Doug and his wife having dinner with Lester and Carol Burden. I felt like leaving, like getting in my car and driving for days and days. But Lester was taking my car anyway, and he was doing it to call lawyers for me. I sat at the table and looked around the cabin at the bare pine walls, the black iron stove, the groceries on the wood chopping block, the steep staircase to the loft. I could hear the Parissima River through the trees. All this quiet was making me more nervous, and I'd wished I'd brought my Walkman from the car. I went outside, squatted at the woodpile, and loaded myself up with a stove full of split logs. Les was gone almost 2 hours, longer than it should have taken him to drive 5 miles to make a couple of phone calls. I'd bought 2 jars of marinara sauce, and I was planning to heat that up in the stove while I boiled some pasta and cooked hot Italian sausages in another pan. But I didn't want to start any of this till Les got back, because on a hot stove it would all get done fast. So after finally getting the fire going, I tossed a 3-grain salad on 2 paper plates, peeled 8 cloves of garlic, diced them with a dull knife, and made half slices in the French bread, then scooped in spoonfuls of margarine, sprinkling in the garlic before I wrapped the loaf in foil. I sat on the porch and smoked a cigarette. At any time, I kept expecting Les to come out of the woods into the clearing, but I sat there for close to an hour listening to the river, an occasional bird, the crackling of the fire in the house behind me. Every 20 minutes or so, I'd go back inside to add a split log to the flames to keep the temperature of the stovetop up. There were only 2 pots and 1 pan in the crate under the stairs, and the pots were small. I'd filled both with clear water from the river, and each had a slow boil going in it. I was going to have to cook the vermicelli in both, then dump the water to heat the sauce, hoping that and the sausages from the pan would be hot enough to reheat the cooled pasta. Though I wasn't too worried about anything cooling off in that cabin, it was hot as a sauna. My shirt was sticking to my skin, and the sweat was beginning to burn my eyes. I poked the fire with a stick, shut the oven door, then walked down the short trail to the Purissima, where I pulled off my top and bra, stepped out of my shorts and panties, and waded out in the cold water and dived in. It was a shock, but I felt instantly cleansed to the bone, and I let myself surface, turning on my back and kicking until I was away from the treetops, and there was nothing but the gray western sky above me. I closed my eyes and drifted a minute, but the water was cold, and I didn't know how deep it was, and for some reason I pictured the fish camp on fire, tall flames curling out the windows, black smoke snaking out the shingles of the roof. I swam back to the mossy bank and dried myself as well as I could with my underwear. I dressed without them and walked back to the camp, which wasn't burning, and there was Lester lugging my suitcase into the clearing from the cars. In his other hand was a covered styrofoam cup of coffee he tried to drink from as he went, his dark eyes on the ground in front of him. When he saw me, he swallowed and lowered his cup. "Go for a swim?" "You get lost?" I reached for my suitcase, but he stepped away with it. "Your foot." "It's fine." I tried to take the suitcase again, but he wouldn't let go, and he walked ahead of me while I stood there watching him make his unsteady way up onto the porch. He dropped my suitcase against the wall and sat down. I stayed where I was. "You go drinking?" Lester looked at me with his eyes narrowed a little, like he didn't quite know how to take what I'd just said. But really, he seemed put out, as if I was interrupting an important train of thought. He flipped the plastic lid off his coffee cup and drank. I crossed my arms and stared at him, my wet underpants balled up in one hand. I was hurt he didn't bring me a cup. I felt refreshed after my swim, and coffee would have been nice right then, before I cooked. I knew I could go inside and make some, though. And I couldn't stand myself looking at him this way, my arms crossed, my head cocked. Why didn't I just start tapping one foot? I sat on the top step of the porch, my back against the post. Lester had both elbows on his knees, holding the coffee cup between his hands, and he gave me a weak smile, then looked over the railing into the woods. His uniform shirt was wrinkled and sweat-stained in the back, and his pant cuffs were riding high on his calves, his black socks fallen to his black shoes, his shin skinny and hairy. A rush of air seemed to go through me. "You don't have good news for me, do you?" I felt selfish asking this, and I wished I could take back the question. Lester studied me for a long minute, then shook his head. "I don't have good news for anybody, Kathy." "What do you mean?" "I mean I'm just a bad news bear, Kathy." He raised his eyebrows at me like it was my cue to laugh. "Did you get loaded before the calls, or after?" Les stared at his small wood pile. "After. But I didn't get loaded. I started to, but then Doug steered me away from it." He looked over at me. "You're so beautiful with your hair wet like that." I was thinking of Doug and the 12-step, higher power bumper sticker on his truck, of letting go and letting God. They can't do anything to Baruni, can they? Les shook his head and I felt my chest sort of disappear. I called 3 lawyers. 2 of them said if he bought it legally, he can do whatever he wants. They say your case is with the county, Kathy. But the county said he'd sell it back to them. I don't want them to buy me another house. Can't we make him give it back? I jumped up and walked out into the clearing. That fucking prick's trying to sell my house, Les. I saw him showing it to people this afternoon. Today? To a family. That fucker just wants the cash. He probably does this all the time, makes money off people's problems. What did the third lawyer say, then?
That was my lawyer.
Well, did he say something different?
I didn't call him about that, Kathy.
Oh. My cheeks got warm and I felt like I'd just walked into a stranger's living room, plopped down on their couch and started watching their TV. I'd been thinking Les came back from his phone calls all down mainly because of my bad news. Now I was ashamed of myself and I didn't know what to say. I needed a cigarette. I went inside the hot cabin and lit one on an ember from the wood stove. I stuck another split log inside, then went back out on the porch and sat on the stoop smoking. Les stood and tossed the last of his coffee over the railing. He leaned against it with his hands, and we were both quiet. Far off in the woods, a dog barked. I guess my wife never saw this coming. I feel pretty bad about that.
You think you're making a mistake?
It was strange, but I felt calm. Les stood there all long-armed and still. He could answer any way he wanted.
What do you think?
Do I think you're making a mistake?
Les nodded.
I can't answer that.
Maybe if you have to ask me, you are.
Then I'm not asking that.
What are you asking me then?
He didn't answer right away, just looked at me. He finally said, Can you put up with me through all of this?
That's what you're asking me?
Yes, I suppose I am.
I think so. Depends on what this is, though.
Lester flicked a paint chip off the railing. Carol's on sort of a rampage. She called the lawyer before me, and she's already petitioned for dissolution. I made some kind of face.
Divorce, he said.
We don't use that word in California. We dissolve marriages here. It's supposed to be a lot nicer for everyone. Just slide into the hot tub and disappear.
And you don't want that?
I want what's best. He peeled up another paint chip and glanced at me. And I know that's what has to happen, but she also asked him some nasty questions about custody and property. She can't do anything against me without mediation, but just hearing it kind of put me over the edge. I went over and hugged him. He felt to me like an old friend, though I didn't have any. It must feel like this, though. They're warm against you, and you love and respect them, and are on their side no matter what. I asked him if he'd like a nice Italian dinner, and he said yes. We kissed and made our way inside, starting to undress, needing to do it, but it was so hot in there we ended up hurrying back down the trail to the Purissima, our arms around each other, and we took off our clothes on the mossy bank, then made love there, Lester pushing in and out of me so fast it hurt a little. His face was all bunched up with the effort of it, and I suddenly felt far away, closing my eyes just as he let out a short groan, pulled out of me, and came across my stomach in a warm, wet line. Maybe it was the hot cabin that got to us, to him. Maybe it was the quiet and the stillness. I think it was all three. The dinner came out better than I would have guessed, and because it was too hot inside the camp, we ate out on the porch, off plates in our laps. Halfway through supper, the mosquitoes began to hit, so we sprayed each other down with repellent, something I'd wished I'd waited to do because the rest of the meal didn't taste quite right. We sat on the porch a while, the two of us looking out at the small wood pile and trees, like old people waiting for someone to visit. The sky was still gray, but darker, and I knew we were close to nightfall. Les was sitting straight in his chair. He'd changed into jeans and that tacky striped golf shirt, and he wore sneakers without socks. But he didn't look relaxed. He'd been sitting with his arms crossed over his chest, his feet flat on the floor, and sometimes he'd wave a mosquito away from his face, then cross his arms again. I thought of my mother and her two sisters and their plan to fly west, and I wished I'd written a better reason for them not to come. I knew if they thought Nick and I would be gone for the weekend, they'd still fly out,
And worse, they'd probably want to stay at the empty house. Shit. What? I told Les about my mother's postcard and about the rest of my mail, the bills I was supposed to pay to keep the Arab family comfortable in my stolen house. You're right, you know. He sat back and looked at me. This guy's received stolen property, and now he's trying to pawn it off. It's not really stolen, though, right? Technically. Lester's breath was starting to rise. That's one thing I hate about law enforcement, Kathy. What? Do you know how many times I see people violate the spirit of the law without actually breaking it? Like the DV law, no matter which spouse does the violence, we have to take them in. That means if a 200-pound artichoke rancher and pescadero slugs his wife and she hits him back, she gets charged too. For defending herself? That's right. We took in this one guy who did a number on his wife, really worked her over. She wouldn't take out a restraining order, and when he got out on bail, he went back to the house and coaxed and taunted her until she started clawing his face. And he stood there and let her do it because he knew the law, and he knew now it would be her turn to sit in a cell. And I can't not take her in. And this Arab son of a bitch, he knows what he's doing is wrong, but the law saves him anyway. The day we drove by, you see the kind of cars parked in front of your house? You see the clothes those people had on? And you're out in the cold. I'm out in the heat. I was smiling. It felt so good hearing this kind of feeling about me and my problem coming out of Lester's mouth. I lit a cigarette. I can't believe we can't just evict him. That's what's so fucked up. Les gave me a long look. His dark eyes narrowed like he was thinking of something else. You said this guy was a colonel? That's what he said. From what country? I don't know, but his wife hardly speaks any English at all. Maybe they haven't been here very long, Kathy. Maybe they don't know their way around. Lester went inside. I could hear him undressing. I'll call INS tomorrow, Kathy. See if they have anything we can use. Use? He didn't answer me. I could hear him pull the plastic off his dry cleaning. I was really enjoying this. Use for what? For the greater good. I listened to him dress, then he stepped back outside, zipping up his deputy uniform pants, tucking in his shirt. He reached into his pocket for some uniform emblems and his gold star badge, pinning them on. What the hell are you doing, Lester? Officers tend to listen to other officers, Kathy. It's worth a shot. Les began to finish buttoning his shirt, but I stepped up and took over, like I used to do for Nicky. What if he doesn't listen, Les? Then we turn up the volume. He laughed at his own line, at the cowboy toughness of it, it seemed. I told him to stay still, and I straightened up his shirt collars and kissed his throat. I was about to say thank you, but he was already stepping off the porch, so I put on my Reeboks, then went out and started the Bonneville while Les unlocked his car. I watched as he straightened to buckle his gun belt on. He looked perfect walking to the passenger side of my car, the creases in his uniform sharp and clean, his badge positioned just under his heart. I noticed he hadn't pinned on his name tag. When he got in and shut the door, I leaned over and kissed him and said, "I love you for doing this, Lester. I really do."
A heaviness of heart possesses me on our new widow's walk. Its cause is remembering Jasmine, but I begin to worry once more of the difficulties I already face in the selling of the home. Even if I were to sell the bungalow at the profit I have projected, I must still be prepared to move my family once again, and this time it will have to be a modest apartment in one of these modest villages along the coast. This will, of course, be the best way to avoid spending my pool while I search for suitable investment opportunities. But I recall my daughter's face, the fashion in which she regarded me at her homecoming dinner, the aggressive and rude way in which she all the night long repeatedly apologized for the family's present living situation by recalling our old life. How will she regard her mother, brother, and me, living in a cottage in a place such as San Bruno, perhaps, or Daly City, with all those Filipino people? Will she be too ashamed to visit, to bring her husband and his family? These thoughts begin to anger me, for who does she think she is to judge her own father? To perhaps pity me? And yes, it was pity I saw in her face that evening as she viewed me in the candlelight at the Soffre. That, and a degree of shame as well. But also, she seemed to me confused at the change we are undergoing, and that is where I blame myself, for I have never let her know of our finances. Even when I worked two jobs for so long to uphold our charade, she never knew what sort of work and where, and of course I would leave the home well-dressed and return as such. Perhaps I maintained this mask for my children out of pride and vanity. Perhaps I was being susul. But enough of all this self-examination. It is a habit I only began to assume after the fall of our society, when I found more time on my hands and upon my shoulders than I would ever wish. I never wanted so much time. I must discipline myself to keep my attention on my present tasks and challenges, to drive into Corona before the department store closes to purchase one or two signs further advertising the sale of the home. I buy two signs, bright crimson letters over black, stating home for sale and for sale by owner. As the sky darkens, I secure the first with string to a utility post at the base of Bisgrove Street. In the sign space reserved for the telephone number, I draw a blue ink arrow pointing up the hill. The second sign I did not think to purchase a stake for, therefore I tape it to the left of the door over the lighted house bell button. Inside our bungalow, Nadi has for me drained a glass of hot tea from the samovar and placed it upon the counter. The soffre is gone from the floor, and I see my wife has changed into her expensive French exercise suit which hangs upon her so loosely. Over this she wears a cotton apron, and she does not approve when I wash my hands in the sink near her clean and drying dishes. "Nakon," she to me says, and she slaps me playfully on the shoulder. I attempt to kiss her quickly upon the nose, and she pushes me away, but her eyes are smiling, and I sit upon the counter and eat a grape. From down the corridor come the strange electronic sounds of Ismail's computer video game. Today, by his own decision, he acquired another newspaper delivery route. In my office, shortly before Nadi called us to the Soffre for dinner, my son told to me he would give me every penny he earns to go towards his education and his future. "And you can buy food with it too, Baba John, whatever you wish." He stood straight before me, his knees skinned once again from skateboarding, his thick hair in need of a brush, and I wished to hold him as tightly and completely against me as I did when he was a small child. But now he was approaching me as a young man of responsibility, and I did not wish to diminish this or take this from him. I stood and shook his hand, which was smooth and warm and no longer smaller than my own. I drink my hot tea. I watch my Nadi dry the rice pot with a towel, and I feel much better than I did only a few short hours ago. This family has overcome challenges far more difficult than the selling of a small bungalow, and with the new signs in place and the advertisements still in the papers, I feel confident we will meet our true buyer very soon. Nadi turns to me with the dry pot in her hands, and she begins to remind me tomorrow is her sister's birthday. She has sent her a gift, but she would like to telephone her early in the morning before the day becomes too late in Iran. She lowers her eyes at me like a young girl and says to me in Farsi, "I promise we will not talk long." I am filled with that old love for my wife, a love of nearly 30 years, and I cannot possibly allow a no to escape my lips. The house bell sounds. Nadi appears startled, and I go directly to the door expecting a buyer, a lady or gentleman who has seen my signs and is stopping to inquire. But standing on the step beneath the exterior electric light is a tall policeman with a thick mustache, and I think immediately of Saraya. Is she all right? The policeman points to the right of the doorway. "Did you post this sign, sir?" "Yes." I feel relief instantly. "Is there a difficulty, officer?" "And that's your sign at the bottom of the hill?" "Yes." The policeman looks over my shoulder into the home, his hands resting on his belt in a very relaxed manner. "Please, come in, officer." I step away and allow him inside. I look behind me and see Nadi has left the kitchen, disappearing into a room, I am certain. I say to the policeman, "I am new to the area. Is a permit required to post signs?" "Not on the house, but the utility pole is city property." "I see. Very well, I will put the sign elsewhere." The policeman regards the painting of the Battle of Martyrdom on the wall, stepping closer to view the framed photograph of myself and General Purat with Shahinshah Pahlavi. I move to the door. I will remove the sign immediately, sir. Thank you for informing me. But the policeman does not acknowledge my movement. He turns to me, and I believe he is smiling beneath his mustache, which I see now is trimmed in a slightly disorderly manner. He says, "You're a long way from home, aren't you?" "This is my home, sir. I am an American citizen." I smile, but a stillness has entered my chest. The policeman walks over the carpet and inspects our family portrait on the table beside the sofa. "Were you a general, sir?" "I was a colonel." I leave the door and join this man, but I stand at the kitchen's counter so he cannot easily look down the corridor to our bedrooms. Now there is a heat in my stomach. I can no longer hear my son's computer video game. The bungalow has become very quiet. "Tell me, officer, what more can I do for you this evening?" He pulls from his belt a small leather notepad. "You can give me your full name." "Are you penalizing me?" "No, sir, I just need your name for my report." I spell for him my name, and then he inquires the names of anyone else living on the premises. "I do not understand. Why is it necessary for to have the names of my family?" I regard the policeman's badge, a gold star, and beneath it, a smaller badge of two pistol barrels crossed together, then another pen, the gold letters F.T.O. "And what is your name, officer?" The man regards me, his jaw muscles tightening a brief moment. "Deputy Sheriff Joe Gonzalez, let me ask you a question, Colonel. Are you selling this house on your own?" "Pardon me? No realtor agency? For sale by owner, right?" "That is correct." "Have you got a title or escrow company to handle it?" "No, I do not." The home is too quiet. Nadi is certainly listening at her door, and I am confused. Why is this deputy asking these questions? I move away from the counter and walk back into the living room area, hoping he will follow. "I do not wish to offend, officer, but if you will excuse me, I have work I must do this evening." "Civil Code 1101, for starters." "Yes, you have informed me of this. I suggest you come with me to witness my removal of the sign." I open the door, holding it for him. "I'm talking about the disclosure law, Colonel. You're not aware of this law?" The officer walks to the opposite wall, where he once again views the framed photograph of Purat and me and Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The policeman keeps his back to me, a deep insult in my country. I still hold the screen door open, but my arm is beginning to tire, and I must take a short breath. "No, officer, perhaps you will tell me." "It means you have to disclose, Colonel. You, the owner, have the obligation to tell any prospective buyers anything about the property they have a right to know." "I do not understand." "You sure about that?" The policeman turns from the wall, regarding me with a smile. I release the door and it closes quietly on its compressed arm. "Are you interrogating me, Mr. Gonzalez?" "I don't know, Colonel. You tell me. I understand your friend the Shah used to make a real habit of it." "I do not know who you think you are speaking to, sir, but I have had quite enough. You have done your job. Now you may leave." I open the door once again, standing to its side. The policeman walks to me. He is taller than I. He smells of garlic and charred wood. "You're used to giving orders, aren't you, Colonel? Let me get right to the point here. San Mateo has offered to give you your money back so this house can be returned to its lawful owner. The county doesn't want litigation on its hands. In fact, Colonel, no one wants any trouble here at all, except you. You don't seem to want to do the right thing, which is to sell this house back at the price you paid so it can be returned to the real owner. The real owner, Mr. Behrani. As far as I'm concerned, you're sitting on stolen property, and in my book, that just won't wash." The policeman walks out onto the step, but I can do no more than look at him. "You have a family. I'd be thinking more about them if I were you. I have more than one contact at immigration. People get deported every single day." "There are a lot of things I can do, Colonel. I suggest you call the mover so I won't have to. Thank you for your time. I know we won't have to see each other again." I watch the policeman walk across my